Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we'll be talking to one Rick Hester. Rick is the curator of behavioral husbandry for the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo in Colorado, USA. He oversees all of the zoo's behavioral programs. These include the zoo's animal training for husbandry, medical and public show behaviors, enrichment, developing programs to improve problem behavior situations, and the zoo's formal animal welfare assessments. He's worked at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo for 15 years. The majority of that time, he was an animal keeper, caring for various species of primates, including many species of Calotricides, old and new world monkeys, and great apes. In 2015, he started working with Dr. Susan Friedman and began to understand the importance of behavior analysis and its application for animals and human care. In addition to his work at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo, he is a consultant and course co-instructor for Susan Friedman's Behavior Works LLC course. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Rick to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Rick, thank you so much for taking the time on your Friday afternoon after work. It's afternoon there for you, early morning for me. So thank you for ending your day and hanging out with us here at Animal Training Academy.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be here. I've been a fan of your podcast for a while now, and yeah, excited to be here and join your really fantastic library. Such a great contribution to our training community and behavior nut community. I'm really glad to be here with you.
Yeah, and I've never been to Colorado myself, but I'm from a distance because of knowing of your work and Jeremy Dillon and through the sharing of Bianca, who's been over there, Papadopoulos from Melbourne Zoo. I just heard such great things about the work that you and your team are doing. So a fanboy here in New Zealand of your organization, super keen to go over there. I know when I walk through the gates of Cheyenne Mountain Zoo one day, I'm going to be like there's going to be so much anticipation and excitement on my end. I just wanted to, well, actually two things. Firstly, hey everyone, Rick was meant to be hanging out with me in November last year in Australia at SeaWorld at our Australasian Society of Zookeeping conference, but COVID, that didn't happen. So I'm doubly excited, Rick, now to get the opportunity and gutted that you couldn't make it to our shores.
Yeah, me too. Hopefully soon. Hopefully we keep trending in a direction that lets us spend some time together in person. But it's nice that we can connect this way in the meantime, for sure.
Yeah, and that will be an exciting time to bring your knowledge and experience from the US, from Cheyenne, from your collaborations and peers over there to Australasia and mingle our communities and what we're doing. It's pretty exciting. I mean, I'm excited about it, and I'm just gutted. I'm gutted. Anyway, nothing we can do about it. But the other thing I wanted to say was, it's exciting that you're co-instructor for Susan Friedman's Behavior Works LLC. And am I understanding correctly that you're also co-instructing or assisting, facilitating, I'm not sure the correct word to use, in Behavior Works' most recent offering, How Research Works?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so Yeah, I'm not sure how I have found myself with the privilege of working so closely with Susan Friedman, but I have for the last 7 years or so, and been working as a co-instructor for Living and Learning with Animals, which we've been offering for a long time, and just filled that role as well for our first offering of How Research Works that just wrapped up a few weeks ago.
Can you tell us about How Research Works? We've had Dr. Elligott on the podcast before, but I'd love to hear from your perspective as well.
Yeah, it's a really exciting course. I think it's the course that our profession needs to help us move even further towards evidence-based practice, to making data-based decisions when it comes to animal behavior change, exhibit design, you know, everything in the zoo world, to move further away from just opinion and to be able to base it on evidence, on data. And the course gives you the skills to locate that evidence, consume that evidence well, be able to vet that evidence, you know, and to sort of evaluate how influential it should be on what you do in practice. So it's a really exciting course, and it was so much fun to be part of. And Christy does a fabulous job teaching it, and it reminded me of taking LLA for the first time, which I did in 2013. You know, you're just like eating up this new information that they're pouring out, and it was just really exciting for me, even in a co-instructor role. And so, that's kind of the basic gist of it, I think.
And that was the inaugural How Research Works offering.
Yeah.
Has there been discussion of future approximations?
I think that it will be offered yearly. So we sort of thread it in between our LLA courses right now. So I think stay tuned for more information on the Behavior Works website about when the next course will happen. But I think it looks like we teach LLA twice a year right now. And so How Research Works fits in the middle right now, I think, between those two LLA offerings.
Yeah, awesome. And did I see that you recently presented with Susan at the ABMA conference as well? Was it?
Yeah, we presented together at Clicker Expo. We streamed live training and consulting here at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo at Clicker Expo, and that was really exciting and fun to do and show people, sort of model the behavior consulting relationship ABA style live with our animals here, coaching through behaviors that we're actually working on teaching. And then we repeated that sort of presentation with the same teams at ABMA. So we liked it so much, we looked for another spot to be able to share that. And it was really fun to be able to do that.
Ah, cool. Well, I know a lot of our audience attends those events, so there might have been some connections made then for those who attended the Clicker Expo and ABMA talk and hadn't made that connection thus far in this podcast episode. So that was Rick and your team, wasn't it? It wasn't just you. It was
That's right. Yeah, we had we worked with African penguins and giraffes. So we had our penguin keepers, trainers, and giraffe keepers, trainers, all as part of that as well, training live and discussing next steps and what we can change and what we all saw as part of the session. So really fun to involve everybody in that.
Cool. And if you're listening to this episode and you wanted to come and hang out with us, I think next week from the time we release this episode, Rick's going to be joining us within our membership with Dr. Friedman, Dr. Elligott, Tim Van Loan, recent ATA podcast guest, and the wonderful Ava Bertelsen to talk more about how research works. And like Tim said, like Rick said, why that's so important in the piece of what we need, what is valuable in our current 2021 approximation of this ever-changing and ever-growing pool of knowledge that we have. And 15 years ago, Rick, you were just getting started. in Cheyenne Mountain Zoo, way before you'd even learned about ABA. I don't know what your focus was then. Was it behavior? Were you getting into the zoo to kind of try to get into behavior, or just looking after animals was your passion? You didn't know what you wanted to do?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. Yeah, I stumbled upon behavior somewhere along the way. I really stumbled upon the zoo as well. When I started here, I was 17 years old. I started as an intern through our local community college, and I was really just doing it as a life experience, a response to my mom's nudging to go and test things out through the college. And so, you know, I signed up and ended up starting an internship here with in the Great Ape area of the zoo. And I expected to spend my time sweeping floors and doing dishes. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll be able to see a gorilla at some point, or, you know, I didn't have any real expectations. I had never even considered what it took to run a zoo, what it was like to work in a zoo. You know, I just sort of jumped in without any real expectation of it. And I remember on my very first day here, the keeper team offered me the chance to feed a gorilla off of a spoon. So to come back and meet a gorilla face to face and feed them off of a spoon. And I remember giving them a little bit of, it may have been grape jelly off of a spoon, and leaving that day thinking, this is it. This is where I want to be, and this is what I want to do. And I have been here ever since that internship. And I spent the early years of my career, most of my career here, working with primates, working with those same apes. I still work with them today. The ones that I met, you know, 15 years ago.
That was roughly 15 years ago, 2009, was it?
It was 2000 and end of 2006 that I started here. Yeah.
Yeah. Look at how good Ryan's maths is. and before that, were you focused on animals? What was your childhood like? Did you have animals growing up?
Yeah, I've always lived amongst animals. My family's always had animals. So, you know, there's pictures of me as a 2-year-old with a chicken that I had that would follow me around and let me carry her. I had a pet turtle sometime around that same age that I still have today. So this turtle and I have been together for like 30 years. And, you know, we had horses and dogs and cats. And so I had geckos and, you know, so I grew up with animals. Animals were always part of our life. But, you know, we didn't really seek to deliberately teach them to do anything. We just kind of lived with them. So, you know, my first exposure to training in a formal way was really in the zoo world.
And when was that? Was that right in your early internship, or how is, I mean, 15 years is a long time with regards to the change that's happened with our knowledge, with the dissemination of knowledge, with the zoo industry as a whole. Where did you first started to learn about positive reinforcement and get your hands dirty or witness others using it?
I saw it in bits and pieces when I was an intern. They were doing positive reinforcement training work with great apes, teaching some basic body presentation type behaviors. And so I saw it a little bit, but it was kind of just part of, you know, I was overwhelmed by what I was seeing because I was learning about everything in the zoo world. It was all new to me. So it was one thing, but it wasn't of particular interest to me at that time. But in 2008, I had been here then for almost 2 years. I was working, I don't even know what I was doing, some part-time work, and think chopping up lettuce in the middle of the night or something. And the zoo hired Steve Martin and Natural Encounters as part of the zoo's new commitment at that time to developing a science-based behavior change program with an aim to improve animal welfare and enhance the experience of the guests that visit the zoo. So before I had ever, I met Steve Martin and listened to his lectures before I had ever attempted to formally teach an animal to do anything. So my earliest training sessions, I had Steve over my shoulder coaching me, and Wouter Stelard, who I think has been on your podcast as well. He was part of NEI at the time, and he spent 4 months here coaching our staff, and Steve would check in and give lectures. And so we were all learning about the science of behavior change, its application in positive reinforcement training, and learning that skill set from them. And at the time, to build up natural behavior animal shows throughout the zoo, our goal was to have one of those types of demonstrations in every animal exhibit in the facility. And so there was this really big institutional-wide push, sort of a revolution, really, of how keepers were spending their time here, what skills we were developing. And that was, you know, right as I had probably just gotten a full-time position here. So that was my early keeper days. So it was really an exciting thing to be part of. And I'm so fortunate that, you know, before I ever even went to train an animal, I had such wonderful mentors to be teaching me and build that skill set.
Yeah, and I feel so many people have been influenced by the names that you just said then, Steve Martin and Wouter Stelard, and I know they've been influential and within Animal Training Academy as well, sharing their offerings. And I'm making an assumption here that that naturally led to hearing about Susan Friedman and then starting to explore the idea of doing her LLA offering?
Yes, it did. So, you know, Steve Martin and Susan Friedman have worked together now for, I think, over 20 years. And so 2008 was the start of our still ongoing partnership with Steve and NEI. And I don't know when, I think it may have been, I don't know if Susan actually came out as part of the, you know, the sort of first year of us working together, but sometime shortly thereafter, she came out with Steve Martin and for one of his consults. And so people were getting to meet her and work with her a little bit. And then it was when Jeremy Dillon, who you mentioned earlier, actually, he took on our animal behavior manager role after spending some time away from CMZ working at the Dallas Zoo. And while he was there, he had taken LLA. And when he came back into the behavior manager role, one of the things that he felt strongly about instituting was providing that course, access to that course to the keeper team. So big props to Jeremy for seeing its value and pressing to have that access available to us. So I was a primate keeper when he came back, and I took LLA for the first time in 2013 with the first group of Cheyenne Mountain Zoo LLA students. And we've sent keepers to it every year ever since. And I think there's only a handful of keepers here who have not yet taken it and will soon take it. So it's just become part of our culture, part of our commitment to that science of behavior change, is giving keepers access to that, at least that basic level information of behavior analysis that you get from LLA. And so I took that class in 2013, and you know, I was hooked on the science of behavior change from that, from the very first lecture, you know, and that's definitely led me to where I am today.
And what was the flow of events that led you to your current title? How did you, was it just something you focused on and it naturally evolved into this role, or how did that all pan out?
Yeah. Alongside access to LLA and taking that course, Jeremy started up a animal training mentor program where he selected keepers who had opportunities to work closely with Steve and Wouter and build up a skill set to train animals and pair us up with other budding keepers in the facility to help disseminate that information. Because, you know, we had access to Steve in a way that other people didn't. And so, so I joined that team and started, that's really when I started learning how to not just train myself, but to share that information with other people and to coach. What does it look like to coach a trainer and not just be the trainer? And so that's really where I started building up that skill set alongside taking LLA And, you know, when all that was happening, it really was a, I think, a shift for me in the sense that from that point forward, I have been 100% committed to the science of behavior change, obsessed with the science of behavior change. It consumes everything that I do. And so I spent, you know, years taking LLA, auditing LLA for a couple of years. And then Susan invited me in to join the co-instructor team. I remember asking her to audit, I think for the third time. And I think in my email, I said, you know, if I can, I'd like to audit again. And I'll probably be auditing this class for as long as you're offering it. You know, I'm not going to stop auditing. I learn something new every single time. And she replied and said, you know, what are you after? If you're after fluency, the best way to get it is to teach. And I think you should consider going through the process of joining the co-instructor team. And so we started working together more closely at that point. And so I've sort of been able to be part of LLA since that point alongside my journey here at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo. And I became the animal behavior manager here, I think in 2018. So it's been 3 years that I've been managing the behavior programs at the zoo now.
One thing we always like to ask our guests to share is stories. I'm not sure about you as a teacher, but for me, I love to teach through story and to learn through story. And I remember myself when I first took LLA and I took the FADE form, functional assessment and intervention design form, and applied it to a challenging behavior, and it worked. And I was like, have you got any similar stories that kind of stick out in your mind that once you started learning this stuff, you're able to apply it and get amazing results?
Yeah. You know, I remember in the very first lecture of LLA that I listened to, Susan taught about what behavior is for. And I'm sure many listening will have heard her teach it in this way, asking her students, what are your eyes for? What are your ears for? What is your nose for? And we all have these quick answers. You know, our eyes are for seeing, our ears are for hearing. And what is your behavior for? And there's just a pause. And we may come up with something, but we don't come up with something quickly. And I didn't have an answer. And so at this point, I had been working at the zoo with animals for many years. And I had never considered what behavior was for. I had learned to train animals. You know, I could change animal behavior. And I had a knack for that. I had success teaching animals to do the things that we wanted them to do, whether it was medical behaviors or to offer these big high energy behaviors that we have in our animal shows. But I had never considered what behavior was for. And when she started teaching that behavior is for effect, it's for producing outcomes. You know, it is part of our biology, and it is the way that we get what we want or get away from what we don't want. And it is our superpower, as Susan Freeman often says. From that lecture on, you know, I was blown away and started uncovering the layers of what was behind how we were teaching animals. So really digging into the science of behavior change and why it works. And then I became a better trainer because I was more informed. You know, I wasn't just guessing based on my past experience. I had my past experience plus we could reference this robust science of how behavior works on the planet to inform how we teach animals. So, you know, it was right away. And the core group that took that class, you know, we were discussing for 2 hours at the zoo after the lecture would wrap up. And then the next day we were going to our animals and we were testing things. We were testing contra freeloading. We were testing these things that we were learning about and seeing that, you know, this is what it is. This is why this stuff works. And so, you know, it was such an exciting experience and definitely had a significant impact on my focus.
Can you share any specific stories?
It's hard to think of like a specific story of an animal that we, you know, that we taught something that we couldn't teach before, or like your fade experience, you know. I know that in general, we were more effective once we had the science behind what we were doing. You know, we did test contra freeloading. Susan tells this story when she teaches LLA, but our elephant manager took the course with us with that first core group, and we were learning about contra freeloading, the tendency for an animal to choose response dependent food over free food, choose food that requires more from the animal, more work. And he was adamant that elephants would not choose to work for food over free food, that they would eat the free food and then they would go and then they might work for the food after the free food was gone. So we set up some tests with the elephants the next day, where we had set up grain in puzzle feeders and a pile of grain on the floor. And the elephants would walk right past the pile of grain straight to the puzzle feeder, finish the puzzle feeder of grain, and then go and get the free grain after they had exhausted the puzzle feeder. And so we did, you know, different trials, changing the position, changing the order, and time again, the elephants go straight to the puzzle feeder. So, you know, it was, we have some really hilarious video of everybody's reaction as the elephants are going to the response dependent food over and over and over again. But, you know, we were just able to see that, you know, that there is a robust science of behavior change that helps us predict what an animal is going to do. And when we know enough to predict it, then we know enough to change it. And then that just sort of took hold throughout the whole facility and became part of our work. We weren't, you know, I remember training one of the first sort of large show behaviors I taught some marmosets to come out of their enclosure and shift through the public space. So they came out through a little door into the public area with guests, and they ran up a branch highway over people's heads and ran to an outdoor enclosure. And we had one marmoset who would periodically stop along the way and sit in the middle for long duration periods of time. So, you know, minutes to hours, just looking calm, comfortable behavior, but just sitting in the middle. The rest of the group is all outside and this marmoset is just waiting. And I taught this before LLA, and in order to try to change what that marmoset did, we just changed aspects of the environment almost randomly. You know, we just said, well, what if this, and what if this, and what if this? And we taught this really persistent stay-in-the-middle behavior. You couldn't have taught the marmoset to stop in the middle of the highway better than we did. In the presence of changing conditions, this marmoset had learned that you just stay put right here. And it was a behavior that lingered forever, you know, periodically resurfacing where, oh, you know, this marmoset's going to spend the next 4 hours right there. And, you know, through LLA, it informed us and helped us move away from this spaghetti on the wall strategy where we're sort of just randomly making changes. And instead we can watch, you know, we learned the ABCs, we learned functional assessment. We can look at what the animal's doing and then look to the environment that in which they're behaving, look to the antecedent conditions, look to the consequences. What is the animal getting or getting away from? And then make informed changes instead of the sort of guesswork approach that I was doing before. I remember when I learned functional assessment the first time in that LLA course, I remember thinking, this is what Steve Martin and Wouter Stallard are doing. They're doing it in, you know, live as they're watching behavior, but this is how they're coming up with what often looks like magic. You know, they're watching an animal do something and they're saying, hey, have you thought about this condition that came right before? And everybody is mind blown. You know, how did you hone in on that aspect of the environment? And of course, they are very talented and very skilled, but they have this science knowledge to back them up. And so, you know, learning that really revealed that to me, like, okay, this is what they're doing. This is how they are identifying the important aspects of the environment to change rather than just sort of guessing at it, which is what I had been doing prior to LLA.
I love how you said, when we know enough to predict it, then we know enough to change it. And you said that's become a mantra. Did you just come up with that while we're recording this podcast, or is that part of what is that part of Giant Mountain Zoo's
mantra? Susan Friedman gets full credit for that phrase. And I definitely heard it from her first. I remember her teaching me and asking me in a zoo audience. She was lecturing and she asked me, why does it matter that we can predict behavior? And that was the response, is that once we know enough to reliably predict it, we have the information that we need to change it. And so that's why it's important. Yeah.
Love it. And I've got multiple questions, but I have a resource problem looking at the time. So I'm going to ask one. And that is, what intervention did you put in place with the marmoset? What antecedents, what consequences, what new behaviors did you train?
By the time that I had learned functional assessment, what it really did was revealed to me how I taught this animal to just sit right there. And because we had given her such a strong history, you know, I mean, it had been years probably of building every summer, building history of this waiting in the middle. Oftentimes when an animal has that kind of history with a really persistent behavior, it requires a large context change. The smaller changes aren't effective because she's already learned to continue to do that in the presence of those small changes. And so we had to rebuild the first portion of the highway. It needed to be a different set of trees. And then she followed the group. We don't have the building where she learned that behavior does not exist at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo anymore, but she is still here and I still work with her. But the building is no more.
Wow, so just the changing of the trees was enough of an antecedent change.
Enough of a context change, yeah. And it was, you know, fairly dramatic because it was cool. essentially the environment where she was waiting, the branches she was waiting on, it was this very particular little nook, didn't exist anymore because we just put new branches in place. But, you know, she remained slower than the rest of the group. She was never as fast as the others. And that may not have been the case had we had that improved skill set when we were teaching it to her initially.
All right. Resisting digging deeper. And I'm going to say thanks for sharing everything so far, Rick. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, as we like to call them. So we're grateful to you for sharing some of yours with us. Moving forward, I'd really like to leverage this opportunity, as we've already been doing, talking to you now, to unpack from your knowledge and experience even more about your application of ABA. One thing Susan continuously clears fog for me about is the universality of ABA to all earthlings. Over time, I feel I see the similarities being greater than the differences between species and individuals. And for me, there is a great coming together of how learning works on planet Earth. And I hypothesize, based on what you've been saying and talking to you a few weeks ago, that it's very similar for you over time, having to work in your organization across such a large and diverse group of taxa. So it might be challenging to stick to just five, but I'd love to know what you might say are the five biggest principles of ABA for you and your team to understand at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo and beyond. I know you're a dad now, so I know it spills out.
It does.
Into home life as well.
It does spill out. It applies to everything, like you said. I love how you put that. These are universal principles of how behavior works. And so as far as we know, they are affecting everything that's behaving on the planet. And, you know, now more research is coming out, even showing how plants are changing what they do, following the same principles of behavior change that all these animals are following, and us as well. So, you know, I guess I will just start by saying that behavior analysis is a really deep well. deeper than even I am aware of. You know, there is something like 100 years of scientific inquiry behind this science, this field. And I am swimming in the very basic stuff. And it has taken me and the animals here in our program here so far that, you know, it's incredible how powerful just the basics of ABA are to effective teaching and ethical teaching, behavior change of animals. So, you know, I guess I can list off things that have been really influential in our work here out of those basics that we sort of swim in. And I think, you know, sort of the hallmark of behavior analysis is that it studies behavior with a natural science approach. And in other words, it measures things that we can observe directly. It measures what animals are doing, not constructed things. So behavior analysis is not trying to explain the ego or the mind or dominance. It is looking at measurable behaviors, what an animal does that we can see. And it is using other measurable, other observable phenomena to explain those things. It's looking to the environment in which an animal behaves that we can observe to account for what they're doing. And so, you know, you end up with this question that I think so many of us have come to ask, well, what does that look like? You know, somebody gives the labels start to fly, or the constructs, you know, this animal is really aggressive, or whatever introduction to the behavior problem situation that you receive and you come to ask, okay, well, what does that look like? Because we're so focused on things that we can observe directly and measure. And so that's certainly a big one. And I think it leads into maybe what we might say is the second one, which is that it is studying the relationship between what an animal does and the environment in which they do it. And that was another really, you know, powerful message for me in LLA. And like we talked about with the marmoset, it led me to understand functional assessment, to look to the environment to account for what the animal is doing, to look to those observable conditions in which they behave. And it's those conditions that we're going to change behavior. The animal is going to be the one who behaves. We change conditions to change behavior. And so that's another really big takeaway, and something that has become sort of a huge pillar of our behavior program here, is that we all understand that in order to change what an animal is doing, we are going to change some aspect of their environment. So I'm really fortunate to work with a keeper team, you know, 40, 45 people who have that base knowledge. So I always say I have the easiest behavior manager job in all the zoo world, because I have this incredible team that is going to be looking to the environment right away with no prompting from me. It's just understood because they've been given access to that information. So that's another big one, I think, is that it's we're going to change conditions to change behavior. So that's where we're looking. We're looking to the environment for an explanation, and also where we're gonna make changes is in the environment.
And you are in a really enviable context, having a team of individuals whom part of your antecedent is their knowledge is disseminated between them. Part of your role is also a consultant to other organizations, am I correct?
Through the zoo, we of course help each other out. We share information when other facilities reach out. And so, you know, I engage in that. And then I do also consult with other facilities through BehaviorWorks with Susan. So we're consulting together at several facilities now.
And what's your, how do you apply what you know about working with your gorillas and your marmosets and your penguins at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo when you go into a new team of keepers where you don't have this a base of knowledge? Is your first approximation to share that, or does it depend on the individuals in the team and the team? What's your mindset going into a new space?
I think it depends It does depend on the team to some degree. And a lot of the consulting since we've sort of started out on that venture has been via Zoom because it's been post-pandemic work. So that's also interesting. You know, we're not walking through a facility and getting to know people like we were 2 years ago. You know, we're having an hour and a half call, often about a specific problem situation. And so we're asking questions around that. But you know, for me, I'm really big on having some groundwork human relationships in order to do any good work together. So I'm always hunting for opportunities to strengthen relationships with my team here, or if I'm going to meet a new team, because I struggle to see how we can influence someone well without having a strong relationship, a history of some shared reinforcers, which you can build up relatively fast if you've got an eye for it. Just to have a little bit of comfortable interactions and sharing some reinforcers before you go out and start training with an animal or discussing a problem behavior situation. And then you can kind of build that dialogue early in order to be successful. You know, I have the vast majority of the information is already there with the people who are working with the animal. You know, I say that to the teams up here at Cheyenne Mountain all the time. Very rarely are they not already 95% of the way to the finish line. And if they need me, then I tend to just add one little nugget of information that helps get them where they want to go. So it's really mostly asking questions because they tend to have all of the information already. And if I'm bringing anything, I'm just bringing a little bit to sort of get them over the hump.
Is it knowing what questions to ask?
I remember, Susan, telling me somewhere along our time together that behavior analysts don't bring answers. They bring the right questions. And that's something that I've held on to and have a running list of those questions. So these are questions like, what does that look like? And, you know, working through a functional assessment. So what is the animal getting or getting away from by performing that behavior? What happens in the environment right before the behavior that predicts its occurrence? You know, these are the types of questions that you sort of get fluent in, and I guess, you know, you have like this pack of questions ready to go, and the right situation sort of evokes you asking them as you build experience. But I've really held on to that approach, and it not only is it very effective, but it's also sort of freeing because you don't have to have the answers. That's not your expectation of your work, that you're going to come in with all of the answers. So you don't have to be the knower. And for me, that was something that was like a great weight was lifted off of me when I didn't have to be the knower. I have some information and they have information, and I can ask questions that help us get, you know, sort of pull out more important information that helps us understand a behavior. And then once we understand it, we can change it.
You're reframing in a way as well. Does that resonate with you when I say that?
Yeah, you absolutely are. You know, it's funny because sometimes you ask what is essentially the same question four different ways, and that's what gets you at the information. That's what helps you really understand what is that relation between this behavior we're interested in and these particular conditions. So I think you are reframing. You're reframing things that everybody already knows, but you ask a question in a particular way and it sort of clicks. Okay, I get it. This is the reason why this animal does this. This is the outcome they're reliably producing. And now we can talk about what we're going to change.
I love it. And number two was studying the relationship between what an animal does and how they do it. And you see, number one is the study ABA studies behavior with a natural science approach, and obviously you're working with a large group of taxa. As we've already mentioned a couple of times, you've spoke about elephants already, primates, numerous others, humans. how do you, as the behavior science, what's your correct title? Remind me.
My title here is the curator of behavioral husbandry.
Right. So as a curator of behavioral husbandry, working with a diverse group of humans, working with a diverse group of species, how do you blend that natural science approach of ABA with other levels of analysis of looking at the individuals and the species, natural history, ethology? How do you as the person who your team goes to for questions, for reframing, how do you blend it all together?
Yeah, I do. So, you know, I have my eye on at least three levels of analysis, you know, so the behavioral level of analysis is the bullseye for me, of course. That's the focus of my work, focusing on behaviors that an animal does that are the result of experience. And we often want to change that in some way. And, but I think there's something like 1,000 animals here. I don't even know how many species they represent. I should know that, but I don't. But like you said, it's I go from chameleons to gorillas, to moose, to elephants, to grizzly bears, to giraffe, all in an afternoon. And, I often start with the ethological level of analysis, understanding a little bit about the natural history of a species. So sort of asking the why would nature want that question? You know, what are the tendencies for this species in the wild environment? With the caveat that most of the animals that I'm seeing do not live in the wild. None of them live in the wild environment, and most of them have never lived in the wild environment, and behavior is dependent on the environment. It's not just inside the animal. So we have that caveat there, but I usually drop in at the ethological level to get an understanding of what are some of the species-wide tendencies in the wild environment, what are some of the species-wide tendencies in the zoo environment, so that I at least have a general understanding of what I would expect from a typical elephant or a typical grizzly bear, knowing full well that the animal in front of me may not represent the typical elephant or grizzly bear, but it gives me a jumping off point. And then with that foundation, I'm working with the individual. You know, that's another aspect of behavior analysis, is that it is the study of one, as Susan often says. It's the study of the individual in front of us, because the behaviors we're interested in are a result of experience, that animal's experience. So, you know, the rest of my work from that early part forward is all about what is this animal doing in front of me and how does the environment account for that? And the other level of analysis that is important is, for my work, is the medical level of analysis. And I keep my eye on that so that I'm not trying to solve a medical problem with a behavioral solution. I may be able to add with a behavioral solution. So if it was a medical problem, it doesn't mean that we don't have anything to offer from a behavioral level of analysis, but we certainly want veterinarians involved. So I also keep a close eye on that. Is this animal physically healthy? Are there any potential medical concerns that would account for what we're seeing the animal doing, and making sure that we have vet teams, you know, working through that with us. So that's one I keep a close eye on as well. And if I'm ever even suspicious that there may be something going on medically, then I have our vet with me and we're working together.
Curious if you have any stories that you've come in and there's a whatever species, chameleon, giraffe, elephant, and you have your ethologically focused question, how does this behavior make sense from a natural perspective? And you just find that this individual in front of you is so wildly down one end of the bell curve based on your personal definition of what the species typical mean average of that particular behavior or whatever it is. Have you got any stories that stand out for you?
I'm trying to think of a specific story. You know, we have numerous individuals in our collection here who represent the tail of the curve, so to speak, of the typical behavior. You know, so we'll joke that, you know, this certainly is the tail of the curve. So, you know, we have, but I struggle to think of like a really specific story that would be good to share.
What about a story where you've come in and you've got your ABA hat on, but there was a medical component that was really salient or potentially not immediately obvious?
Yeah, I do have a story with a giraffe. So we have a really robust hoof care program here with our giraffes. So we have the what I think is currently the largest herd of reticulated giraffe in the U.S. We have 16 giraffe currently. We fluctuate between 16 and 20 individuals generally. And all of our giraffe participate in voluntary hoof trims with a farrier. So they're trained to approach us, and they offer us their feet up on a wooden block and allow a farrier to trim and shape those hooves as part of our sort of basic husbandry medical care for that species. And we had an older individual, female, who had stopped participating in that hoof care. And so the trainers called me down to take a look, and they had relaxed criteria, and they were just reinforcing her for approaching the wooden block, and for she was lifting her foot up and putting her toe just on the edge of the block, far back from where we would typically shape for that foot to be placed. And the trainers were looking for a behavioral solution. You know, how are we going to shape through this regression that has come along with this behavior? And somewhere halfway through the session, in the questions that I was asking, you know, we started talking about, you know, when's the last medical assessment with her? When are our last radiographs? What medications is she on? Is she being treated, you know, for any pain management? You know, she's, I think she was nearly 30 years old at that time. And, so we decided that we would just hold off on training and let the vets assess, let the vets reevaluate how they were managing her pain medications. And so the vets made some adjustments on their end, and the giraffe was back to fully participating in the program, and we didn't change anything about our training. And so it was a standout example for me of the need to just keep our eye on that medical piece, because we may have been able to train through that discomfort and to get her back to participating. But we would have been missing an important piece of that puzzle had we just approached it purely as a behavioral challenge.
Yeah, I'm sure that lesson's front of your mind often when you see variations in behaviors that might not immediately seem like they make sense. My understanding that number three is working with an individual, focusing on the individual.
Yeah, I think it certainly deserves a spot. Is that, yeah, it's the study of individuals. You know, we're looking for behaviors that are the result of experience, that animals experience. And so we know that they're not going to be the same species-wide, even if there are species-wide tendencies. But we know that they have different experiences, and so they're going to behave differently from one animal to the next.
Yeah, and I mean, going even deeper, I just watched a trailer of a Netflix program about epigenetics and how much those things can change the individual. Anyway.
Yeah, it's incredible. Anyway. Everything is flexing. We live on a flexible planet. It's not static. Nothing seems to be static.
What's number four?
I think, you know, when we have sort of this foundation that we're building, you know, we understand that we are measuring what an animal does, and we're looking to the environment to account for that. And that behavior is functional. Behavior is our way of producing outcomes of value. So everything an animal does repeatedly is attached to an outcome of value for that animal, because if it wasn't, they won't keep doing it. And I think that informs how careful we are when we want to change what an animal does, because we know that it matters to them. They're producing something that matters. That's why they're doing it. And I think when you have that understanding that that's what behavior is for, behavior is about being effective, then it shifts our focus away from stopping behavior and towards replacing behavior. So we don't really seek to stop behavior. We seek to replace it because we're not built to be still. We're not built to do nothing. We have evolved to behave for effect. That's part of our biology as much as any other aspect of our physiology and the body that an animal has. Their behavior is just as much a part of their biological inheritance, and it's about being effective. So, we're not looking to stop animals from doing things. We're looking to replace the things they do and ideally give them alternative ways to access those same valued outcomes, just with behaviors that are more appropriate as deemed by us, it's always appropriate, so to speak. It's working, they're behaving effectively, but sometimes those behaviors don't jive with our relationship with them, the way that we need to work with them. And so we provide alternatives.
Now, I'm sure Rick's going to be accusing me after this episode for continuously putting him on the spot and asking for examples, but I'm curious, traveling out of the zoo to your home life, how have you brought this home to being a father, and can you think of an example where we had to replace a behavior at home rather than stop a behavior that was happening with one of our offspring?
Yeah. We have had to replace behavior at home, certainly. I have a 4.5-year-old daughter, Perrin, who is wonderful. And fortunately, I was able to access all of this information before I became a parent. I sometimes wonder what she would look like if it had been the other way around. I think we're all fortunate that I was able to access the information first. And my wife as well. So she is a super talented animal trainer, my wife Mandy, and great ape keeper here at the zoo, who I met early on in my career here. And so we were both able to access this information together and apply it as parents, which has just been such an incredible experience. And there's nothing more fun than being a parent, and nothing more exciting than watching these kids learn and behave. As far as replacing behavior, we did work to replace, if we were talking. So, we get home from work and we want to talk about something that happened during the day, or, then, Perrin learned that she can just yell to interrupt our conversation and get our attention, of course, like really effective. So right away, it produces a valued outcome, attention from mom and dad. And just working to replace that with a calmer ask for our attention. So I think lately it has become, can you zip the lips? Or a request of something like that, so we can have some dialogue around it instead of just yelling at each other. I think that's what she's saying now is, mom and dad, can you zip the lips, please? And so, often before we talk, we'll just let her know, hey, we have this one piece of information that we need to share with each other. So we're going to do that really quickly. And then we'll do this. So she has an expectation, but just sort of replacing the just yell to interrupt the conversation with a more polite ask that produces the same outcome. Mom and dad will stop talking about boring work talk, as Perrin calls it, and engage in whatever it is that we need to be doing, a tea party or building an animal rescue center or whatever she's into for the night.
Thank you for sharing a little bit about Perrin and your home life with us. What a context to be growing up in with dual parents who both understand the science of behavior. That's an exciting thing to think about. Number five, Rick, what's your last out of an infinite? Oh, yeah. I love how you put it. How do you say it? Behavior analysis is a very deep well. There's something like 100 years of scientific inquiry, and I'm swimming in the very basic stuff. So I feel that, and I've never been able to articulate it so well as you did earlier in this podcast. From your swimming at the top layer of this very basic stuff, what is number five?
Oh, it's so tough. I think that because because ABA is a teaching technology, it has this focus on what's most useful or effective, because, like the other day, Susan was saying, when a behavior analyst is working with a kid who, say, can't read, and they start running a program and it's not effective, so they get that feedback that it isn't changing the behavior in the desired way, they then change what they're doing based on that evidence, based on that feedback. Because they're going to be successful. Behavior analysts don't fail. So if it doesn't work, they look at that information that they have now and they change what they're doing until they produce that desired behavior change. And so there's this aspect of usefulness that I've kind of glommed onto, and there's so much information about behavior, and it's all really interesting. And some of it in that deep well is, really, really interesting, and maybe doesn't necessarily immediately impact what I'm going to do tomorrow with 1,000 animals up here or with Perrin. And I think that this question may come from Carl Cheney, who is Susan Friedman's mentor, who I have a little bit of access to through her, as she continues to grow in her fluency and understanding of how behavior works as well. She's such a great model for this. You get your expert card by continuing to learn and change as you grow in your understanding. And, she has a story where she had spent, all this time trying to understand what this, behavior analyst was teaching. And she had finally figured out the nuances and connected the dots. And, she told Carl about it, and he said, great. Good job. You've got it. Now, does that change anything that you're going to go do? And she said, no, it does. It doesn't have any impact on what I'm going to do. And so that story has resonated with me. And, there's only so many hours in the day, and I'm awake for most of them. I don't sleep very much. So I spend a good chunk of my life studying behavior change or applying it here at the zoo or at home. And so, I've come away with this sort of trying to be disciplined and focus on the information that is most impactful for what I'm going to do tomorrow, the most useful information. And that's what I'm choosing to disseminate, whether that is here with our teams at the zoo or at other zoos, is the information that I think has the biggest impact on what they're going to do, what's the most useful information. And a nice thing about that too is that not everyone is as excited about behavior change as I am. Not every single person working with animals wants to do nothing but change behavior and learn about behavior. And so I think it's helpful to have that focus on what's most useful. If I can only give you three things about how behavior works that you can use tomorrow to help that animal move from point A to point B, or to station and allow you to draw blood, or to get a weight, or whatever it is, whatever the need is, I've come away with that sort of wanting to focus on the most useful things, the things that I think are going to have the most impact on what we do tomorrow.
I love that story with Carl Cheney. I think Susan's got many Carl Cheney stories that stick out in my mind as well. I was curious if you were going to start to talk about there's always a better tennis player story.
Yes. It's a great story to Susan will often say, for those that haven't heard her say it, which maybe most have at this point, that, it's important to always find a better tennis player, so to speak. That's always the analogy that Susan uses. And, it's sort of a dangerous place to be the best person in the room at something, because it's harder, I guess we would say harder, less likely to be able to grow, to change what you do, to learn more. And so, I've been so fortunate to have Susan as a mentor, and, it really has instilled in me that need to always have a mentor, at least one mentor who you are bouncing ideas off of, who's pushing your understanding and adding new information. Find yourself a mentor is the sort of the takeaway. because it's so important, or a community that you can go to like this one that is sharing new information, and like the Behavior Works community and those courses where you can get outside your comfort zone a little bit, or, you know, come into contact with new information. And it's just not something that we can do very easily on our own. So you've got to find the better tennis player.
Just one last question before we head towards the end. More of a personal one. I hope it's okay to ask. I know there's lots of people out there working in zoological organizations who might be in similar position than yours, envision being in a position like yours, dreaming of the day there exists a position like yours at their zoological organization, who, if they're listening to this show, probably are equally absorbed with information and practical application of the stuff we've been talking about today. There's additionally individuals in organizations with varying levels of resources available to implement some of the amazing stuff that you've been talking about. And it can be challenging to navigate limited resource spaces. How do you make sure to look after yourself if your whole world is behavior? Do you take time away from that? And what is your self-care type of system processes?
I may not be the world's best model in this particular area, so I don't know that I'm going to offer great insight for people to be following. But, you know, I am a fairly intense individual, so everything that I get interested in, I sort of do in this all-consuming way, you know. So to give an example of something that is, it is behavior, but it's not behavior change. It's not the science of behavior change. You know, in before I had my daughter, I think it was in 2014, I went on a run with a friend. I didn't run, but I went on a run with a friend and I had fun. We ran like 8 miles and I was like, oh, I've never enjoyed running, but I really enjoyed this run, so I think I'll run a marathon. So I started to look for local marathons and training for a marathon. And then finding a marathon, I realized that there are ultra marathons. People run more than the marathon. And so I thought, okay, well, that's what I need to do then. So I, in 8 months from my first run, you know, sort of other than like being a kid, you know, and running around, I ran a 50-mile ultra marathon in the mountains of Colorado at something like 12,000 feet of altitude 8 months after that first run. And that's probably a really good analogy for how I do most everything, including my approach to understanding the science of behavior change. So, you know, I'm running that marathon, right? I'm up all night reading and looking at articles and watching videos and I don't really break. I just keep going. So I don't really take breaks. So I'm a terrible model for self-care and like moderation. I'm just not the model for that.
You've done this entire podcast episode, and obviously everyone listening to these episodes can never see the guest, and we often talk about what the guest is, what they have in their environment, or what facial expressions. You've done it all with a massive smile on your face, and I'm assuming that you did an ultra. I mean, 8 months from running to an ultra marathon. Is that what you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have a massive smile on your face the whole time?
I don't know if I had a massive smile on my face for all 50 miles. I think I did for like 43 miles, and I don't think I smiled much for the last 7 miles.
Yeah. You're in pain?
Yes, I was in a lot of pain.
Cool. That's I'm curious. You're curious. You're an enigma to me. I wonder, like I just know about myself and others in our community that kind of absorption can be really challenging to kind of work through. But for you, I don't get the feeling that that's the case. So when I say you're an immigrant, I'm curious about how your mind works. But that's not what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, we may need another podcast episode. But yeah, you know, I'm energized by it. I'm so fortunate
That's cool.
I get to spend my days doing something that I am so interested in. I'm so enthusiastic about, and all day long I'm looking at animals and what they do and understanding it, and I'm excited about it. So, you know, it's not a grind. I'm happy to do this for 20 hours today and sleep for four. It's my preference.
I am curious, like I said, but we're going to head towards the end of this episode, sadly, because, like I said, I have a million questions. For this final question, though, we're going to head into the future. Rick, you've been working at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo for 15 years now, and you're working with a team of 40, 45 keepers now. You're working with all of these different species. You're working with Susan Freeman. You're working with other zoological organizations. You're speaking to some of the biggest conferences in our industry. And I feel you've got a lot to share with our audience here with regards to where this is all going. What do you envision happening over the next 5 to 10 years with all of this information and humans working with all species of earthlings?
I'll use what I think will happen at Cheyenne Mountain as my example, but I think that it will be something that permeates out in the zoo community. And that is, you know, we've spent now since 2008 this time building a formal training program, building teachers, building skills to teach animals to do things. And now we have that, and of course we'll maintain that and we'll continue to grow. But I've become, and the program and the teams here have become really focused on the exhibits in which these animals are living, and starting to think about what are all of the naturally occurring reinforcers that are available in that environment for an animal to go produce. And so these are things like shade, you know, or to be up high or to be lower, or to wallow in the mud, or to go bathe, or, you know, reinforcers that are the sort of natural outcome of those responses. And they are not delivered by humans. They're not directly delivered by us to fill the gap between our interactions. So, you know, our animals clearly enjoy, I would say, based on their behavior, training with our keepers. They come over quickly. They are attentive. They choose keeper interaction over other opportunities. So there's a reflection of how reinforcing those interactions are. But they are brief, and the animals are here 24 hours a day. And so, you know, they may spend 20 minutes or less interacting with a keeper. And so the idea of enrichment is not new, but I do think that it, in many facilities, and certainly in ours as well, is not as robust as it will need to be to fill these animals' lives. And in order to do that, we're going to need to be able to design stimulus-rich environments that and build the skills that animals need to access those reinforcers. So that's been a lot of what my work has been here over the last year. An example of, I'm going to be ahead of you this time with an example. So an example of this work is most recent is in our African penguin exhibit, which we actually just built. So it's a multi-million dollar penguin exhibit. It's absolutely beautiful to look at. But the penguins did not do the things that we wanted. And so, you know, when I wasn't part of the original design, it takes many years to design a zoo exhibit. So I wasn't even in this role when the design process was happening. But we opened it a year ago, and the penguins have three really beautiful pools, and they didn't swim hardly at all. They were hiding in caves most of the time. So guests couldn't see them. They weren't swimming. And so we went to work. We started to look at the environment, look at what the penguins are choosing to do, and build an understanding of penguin natural history, tendencies in zoos, and what we were observing with our penguins. And we ultimately designed a remodel, and we remodeled our brand new exhibit to promote the behaviors that we wanted to see. And we had penguins who, in the original exhibit, were rarely swimming during the hours that guests were here. To our penguin flock today, that swims between 30 and 40% of the time that guests are at the zoo. And so not only do we have this really great guest experience, but I think we have a significant welfare improvement for those penguins who are in the water contacting naturally occurring reinforcers. Now, 40% of the time they're spending swimming, and before they weren't swimming at all. And we did that with an exhibit redesign, mostly some changes to feeding strategies, but it didn't revolve around keeper led changes. It revolved around redesigning the space that they're living in. And so I'm coming to have more of an eye for that, for what fills the gap between our training and what reinforcers are they going to produce throughout the day? And how can we design exhibits that are going to fill these animals' lives with those types of opportunities? We're doing some work with elephants now as well, exploring that, you know, where if I can spend an hour, how could that hour best be spent? Is it filling puzzle feeders, or is it out in the yard with a bobcat building sand hills? And then they're out there in the sand engaging. So we're testing different things to see what produces, what evokes that enthusiastic engagement that's going to fill up their day in between those keeper-led interactions.
I like that. I feel like that's a lot of my focus at home as well with our two house cats and our dog, is just redesigning our house, which we've currently got two enclosures attached to and tunnels down the side, and just remodeled our garage. Our car doesn't have a home anymore. It's a cat enclosure. but I kind of feel like it's not, sometimes it's not as sexy as training, but I feel like what I'm doing at home is in the same direction as what you're talking about. And it fits in that the first part of Susan Freeman's hierarchy is, I don't think you're talking about interventions here.
I mean, we are in a way, you know, so we are, I think we're talking about interventions in the sense that we're looking to change what an animal is doing, whether we're looking for them to do more of something. You know, it's not always less of something. Sometimes we're just looking for more of something. So, you know, we were looking for more swimming, and we got less hiding in caves as a byproduct of that. But the focus of the program was more swimming, both for guest experience and for penguin welfare. But I think what you're describing with your cats and the tunnels and the garage is exactly what we're talking about. What's going to, you know, if you leave home for 8 hours, what fills that time? And I mean, in the sense that, what are the reinforcers they're going to be able to produce? What are their opportunities to go be effective and produce reinforcers that are not coming directly from us, and fill the rest of that day that our training really doesn't do that well? Our training does a great job of building their skills and building relationships with us, and building resilience in those animals. But it doesn't do a great job of filling a 24-hour day. You know, for many species, like a giraffe sleeps 20 minutes a day. So they're awake for almost even more than me. And so we've got to fill that time with opportunities to behave for effect. And it's going to be I think the spaces they're in is going to be play a big role in that. It won't just be food. So I think we have to kind of, it's been hard for us here and hard for me too, to challenge ourselves to think of what are all the many reinforcers an animal behaves to produce in a day that's not just food. Food's so easy and we're so used to using it, but there's so much more. And that's what we're kind of challenging ourselves to discover. What are all the reasons this species tends to behave? What are they behaving to get? And how can I design a space that provides those opportunities as well?
We are saved by the bell because I want to ask for more examples, but we don't have time. Hey, can you let everyone listening know, Rick, where they can go to find out more about the stuff you're up to at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo, about the zoo as well? And if they wanted to get in touch with you, is there a way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I'm not on social media, so you can't get in touch with me there, but you can always email me. Maybe we can just attach my contact information to this. And so never hesitate to reach out. I'm always happy to hear from people. And then if you're interested in some of the work, You can go onto Shy Mountain Zoo's website or Facebook page. So there's videos of our training and animals engaging and some of these opportunities that we're describing are posted on those feeds. And then same for behaviorworks.org and BehaviorWorks Facebook page for the work that Susan is doing that I'm privileged to be a small part of. Those are two great places to go.
Exciting. And we will, of course, link to all of that in the show notes as well. Rick, this has been so much fun making you awkward and putting you on the spot with all my examples of asking for examples. So from myself and on behalf of the Animal Training Academy audience and everyone listening, we're so grateful to you for everything that you're doing to help learners, both humans and non-humans, live the best lives possible. And we're grateful to you as well for making time to come on the show with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.